Number 08-1652, Vasquez versus McCasey. Mr. Petty.
Good morning, Your Honors. Roy Petty from Rogers, Arkansas, for the petitioner.
Welcome.
Before I began doing immigration law, I did civil litigation. I'm sorry?
Where's Rogers, Arkansas?
It's a very far northwest corner of the state in the Ozarks. Beautiful place. Please come down for a visit.
Must be a difficult trip to get to Chicago.
It was a long trip, yes.
Interrupted
by a hearing in Kansas City on the way. So, before I began doing immigration law, I did civil litigation. In one case, I was co-counsel where our client was a deaf woman who claimed that she had been denied a promotion and subject to discrimination because of her handicap. This case should have settled, but it didn't. It went to trial. The trial lasted 22 days, 22 full days from morning till afternoon, with I don't know how many witnesses being examined and cross-examined and a lot of arguments among the lawyers. I walked out of that hearing thinking that that was too much due process for that kind of a case. Not long after that, I switched to immigration law and discovered, to my shock, that people whose claims were that they would be murdered in their homeland or their lives would be destroyed in one way or another were given half a day or less to prove their cases through an interpreter, usually, which certainly slows the process down. And I thought that in the first case, we were dealing with way more than enough due process, and in the second example, somehow it just wasn't enough. The tenets of...
Did your appeal to the BIA include a constitutional due process claim?
It did not.
The idea is that this hearing was so short, it was a denial of due process, and I'm not sure that that issue was presented to the BIA as a due process issue.
It did not, and I deliberately did not include that because I didn't feel that they really had any jurisdiction to decide that on their own and that it would not have been successful. I don't think that's a failure to pursue an administrative remedy because we did actually file the appeal. It's not like we were seeking a different form of, or we failed to seek a different form of relief. It's an argument that I felt was inappropriate to make before the board.
I'm curious, why would that be an inappropriate argument to make before the board?
It would presuppose that they would be unable to address the appeal simply on the merits of their own jurisdiction, which is to determine whether the judge's decision was correct or was an abuse of discretion or not.
Part of the judges, but we always have issues raised in the alternative. Now, if you disagree with me on this, we are claiming a constitutional violation. We're, I think, fairly clear that these issues have to be fully raised before the BIA, give the BIA its first crack at correcting what might be an error.
I understand that, but I think it's different from failing to raise the way I look at the lack of pursuit of administrative avenues is more along the lines of if we fail to seek some form of relief or some outcome that was different from what we're seeking now. And I view this as an argument. And actually, in terms of analyzing the case and determining whether to file a petition for review, part of it involved looking at the board's decision and seeing did they commit the same mistake. Error, in my view, which is failing really to give the case enough consideration given the gravity of the issues that were involved. At any rate, in any event, I have always thought about Matthews versus Eldridge and its weighing of circumstances and thought it was a very reasonable approach to determining these cases. I would note that my formal client here is Aura Chavez, who's a 34-year-old woman from Guatemala. She is not a lawful permanent resident, but she has been living here legally as an asylum applicant or under color of law as an asylum applicant for the past 17 years. And she fled Guatemala after having bad experiences there with the guerrillas and sought safety here. But the people with the greater stake in the outcome of these proceedings are her children. Her two sons, Melvin, 14, and Henry, age 7, they are U.S. citizens. They have lived their entire lives here, and they face the prospect of possibly being forced by circumstances to move with their mother to a foreign country that they know nothing about, and not just any foreign country. And the basis of our appeal is an extremely poor and an extremely dangerous foreign country. Melvin and Henry, as citizens, certainly do have a liberty and property interest at stake in these proceedings since they're citizens, and since they face the prospect of either losing their country or losing their mother. The interesting thing about cancellation of removal for non-permanent residents at 8 U.S. Code 1229B is a very peculiar form of relief because under no circumstance are we to consider the hardship to the applicant, to Aura Chavez. The only consideration, except for her first determining that she's been here for 10 years or more, and secondly determining if she's a person of good moral character, the real issue in these cases is whether or not there will be exceptional or extremely unusual hardship to her immediate family members, children, spouse, or parents who are citizens or lawful permanent residents. That's the whole focus of these cases. As far as I know, it's the only immigration remedy where that's the case, where the persons whose interest is most directly at stake are citizens and permanent residents. It is a discretionary remedy. I'm well aware that the statute, because it's an discretionary remedy, and the statute at 1252A2B1 would bar jurisdiction based solely on discretionary decisions. But the exception that's carved out is where there is a due process or a constitutional problem. My observation would be that where there is a discretionary decision to be made and very little guidance from either the board or from the statute itself as to what are the elements that go into that exercise of discretion creates a particular makes it particularly vulnerable to being subjected to due process violations that if it's purely discretionary, then the procedural aspects of the case must be very carefully concerned. In this issue, in this specific case, my gripe was that the judge, who's a very good judge, a judge that I know personally and admire, but she has too big a caseload and too much stuff going on, didn't take into effect at all or account at all the fact that the country of deportation for my client was Guatemala, not Mexico, which has been the focus of the Board of Immigration Appeals decisions, and that conditions there are dramatically worse than in Mexico or in most other countries. She didn't give any consideration to that. She didn't do it because she's a bad person or was biased against us or anything like that. She didn't have time. We had 2 hours allotted for this hearing because she had a hearing in the afternoon, and I assume two or three more the following day and the day after that. I think a fair question that the government has raised and will raise is that whether I'm trying to cloak this appeal in constitutional garb as a way of bootstrapping jurisdiction to quote Zamora Malari versus Mukasey. That's a fair question, and one that I certainly wrestled with, but my argument is not just to quibble with the judge's decision and say, well, she made a wrong decision, she should have evaluated this more than other, but to say that because of the procedure, because of the system under which she works, that she and I and the board are all prisoners of the case volume that's before them, that really unable to provide fair, a complete and fair adjudication of that case. There isn't a lot of law to apply, there isn't a lot of guidance on how to apply it, and there's very little time to resolve these things. I'm out. I'm sorry. Thank you, unless there are any more questions.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Iverson.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Julie Iverson, and I represent the United States Attorney General.
Can you just tell me how, when a case like this, everything is in Missouri, ends up being heard by a immigration judge in Chicago?
Yes, Your Honor. This case was heard over televideo, where the attorney and I believe the interpreter and the current petitioner was in Missouri, and the immigration judge was in Chicago.
I understand that, but why? Isn't there a place closer? St. Louis does these sorts of things, don't they?
Your Honor, I believe there's no immigration court in St. Louis, and so I believe that the alien doesn't have to travel to Chicago. They set up some sort of system where the alien can appear closer to where she resides.
So you're saying there's no immigration court in St. Louis?
I believe there is not, Your Honor. Maybe Ms. Chavez's attorney knows if there is or not, but I don't believe there is. So because there can't be an immigration court in every city, the Executive Office for Immigration Review has set up a system where aliens appear via televideo and there's an immigration judge sitting in another city. For example, I used to be the law clerk in Arlington, Virginia, and they would hear cases in Ohio until there was an immigration court put into Cleveland. And also there's, at the headquarters immigration court, it's an exclusive televideo court where they hear cases from all over the country, but the immigration judges are sitting in Arlington. But this court actually has addressed whether or not that is constitutional to hear cases.
I'm not concerned about that. I'm just wondering why. And if you're telling me there's no immigration court in St. Louis,
I don't believe
or any place in Missouri or any place in the Eighth Circuit.
Your Honor, there is an immigration court in the Eighth Circuit, but I'm not sure where. I haven't had to brief anything in the Eighth Circuit yet, so I honestly don't know. Okay. Your Honors, we believe this petition should be dismissed because the court lacks jurisdiction pursuant to 8 U.S.C. 1252A2B to review the board's discretionary determination that Ms. Chavez failed to meet her burden of establishing the requisite exceptional and extremely unusual hardship to her qualifying relatives to merit cancellation of removal. Moreover, Ms. Chavez has failed to present a colorable constitutional claim or question of law over which this court may exercise its jurisdiction. What Ms. Chavez does impermissibly do is invite the court to reweigh the evidence regarding hardship in contravention of Congress's intent to insulate cancellation of removal hardship determinations from review. Here, Ms. Chavez received a fair hearing before an immigration judge, albeit in Chicago over televideo, in which she proceeded with the assistance of counsel. The immigration judge received and considered all evidence presented by Ms. Chavez, including her testimony and the testimony of her eldest son. The immigration judge issued a written decision 6 months after the hearing was completed, in which she balanced all the hardship factors presented by Ms. Chavez, which was consistent with the agency's precedent, and reasonable given the record. But quite simply, the immigration judge was not persuaded that there was hardship substantially beyond that which ordinarily would be expected to result from parents' deportation. Specifically, the immigration judge considered the separation of Ms. Chavez's children from their family and friends, the lower standard of living in Guatemala, diminished economic opportunities in Guatemala, access to education and medical facilities, legal status, the undocumented legal status of the children's fathers, the children's Spanish language abilities, and the younger son's visits to the doctor in the United States, and crime in Guatemala. She issued a written decision, not the day of the hearing, but 6 months later. To the extent that Ms. Chavez asserts that her due process has been violated, this claim fails for three reasons. First of all, an alien has no due process-based right to discretionary relief. In this case, the discretionary relief is cancellation of removal where there is no liberty or property interest. Secondly, as Your Honor noted, Ms. Chavez did not exhaust her administrative remedies. This court has said that where a due process argument is based on the procedural failings that the Board of Immigration Appeals is capable of addressing, the petitioner must exhaust her remedies to the board. She did not do so. If she had raised this issue to the board had the authority to remand the case to the immigration judge for a new hearing. But because she did not raise this claim to the board was not on notice that this was an issue. And thirdly, Ms. Chavez has not shown that she was prejudiced by the alleged brevity of her hearing. She said that her hearing was only 2 hours long, but she has not asserted any evidence that she was unable to present because the hearing was 2 hours long. In her opening brief, she asserts that the record was thin, but it's her burden to show that she's eligible for cancellation relief. If the record is thin, that's something that she needed to develop further. To the extent that Ms. Chavez says that our search that her children would be deported or that they have some sort of due process-based right, this court also considered this argument in Martinez-Maldonado versus Gonzalez, 437 F3D 679. The petitioner in that case made the same argument that the children would be de facto deported because their parent would be deported. And this court found that the jurisdiction stripping provision applied in that case as well. If there are no further questions, Your Honor. Because Ms. Chavez is challenging the discretionary hardship determination of her cancellation of removal denial, and she has not raised a constitutional claim or question of law, we ask that this petition for review be dismissed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Petty, you're out of time, but because you came all the way from Arkansas, we'll give you another minute.
I'm not sure that I need to add a lot to my former argument except to observe that the reason the record is thin in cases like this is we know going in that we only have 2 hours. If you know that that's how much time you have, you've got to tailor your case to that small amount of time, and it is no small challenge to try and put that evidence together. If we'd had a day, if we'd had 2 days, we would have put on a much different case. I also disagree with counsel's observation about the board or the judge's decision actually considering the issue of current country conditions in Guatemala. It's really made reference to only just in passing. It's an issue of great import because of Guatemala is basically a non-country. It's a good deal like Somalia. It's almost a failed state, a place that's one of the most violent on earth with one of the highest murder rates. That's all I have to say. Thanks.
Thank you. The case is taken under advisement. We'll proceed to case 5 of the day, appeal number 08-7.